Welcome back to the special Philadelphia Science Festival edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. One of the most curious exhibitions at Philadelphia's Mutter Museum is Chevalier Jackson's Foreign Body Collection. It includes 2,000 seemingly random objects, all extracted from patients who had swallowed them, including a padlock, a toy goat, a tiny pair of binoculars, a beaded crucifix. Chevalier Jackson was the laryngologist with the enthusiasm and the skill to not only extract these objects, but to catalog and archive them. Author Mary Capello examined the life of Jackson and his work in her book called Swallow, Foreign Bodies, Their Ingestion, Inspiration, and the Curious Doctor Who Extracted Them. She joined me in 2011 to discuss this foreign bodies collection and why she found it so inspiring. Let's take a listen. So what was your first impression as you looked at this drawer or these drawers filled with objects?
I was absolutely fascinated, riveted, in some ways overwhelmed, mostly curious. And, you know, at first I was struck by the collection just as a collection, almost as a strange and terrifying work of art, as an assemblage. And I thought of it actually originally just in poetic ways, because there's a sense of each object, once it's in this little frame that Jackson has supplied it with and gathered together by type,
yes,
you're in this realm of something somewhat magical. So at first I was drawn to it in that way. And then I learned that Jackson had written a best-selling autobiography in 1938. And being a writer and a reader and teacher of literature, I, of course, was instantly drawn to that. I read the autobiography, and this is what made me realize there was a book waiting to be written about the collection. Once I read the autobiography,
right,
then I came back to the collection again and had the sense that then there are the lives of the people attached to the objects. Ah, there's a book here that could treat these three dimensions.
I have to say, your book, which is about Chevalier Jackson, but it's also gets us to think about swallowing. The title of your book is Swallow, but the notion of choking, and I think anyone who has choked on something, I mean, you do sometimes feel like you are going to die
because you
cannot get your breath.
Of course.
You feel like you can't dislodge this thing that's in your throat, and it's a very frightening experience.
Well, this is because the airway and the food way in human beings enjoy or do not enjoy a precarious proximity.
Meaning we use them both.
Not just we use them both, but they are contiguous with one another. They, as they put it in medical discourse, share a party wall. And that because of the descended larynx, it has something to do with our having stood upright many million years ago, that human physiology is such. It's not so for other mammals. And so this little flap at the back of the throat called the epiglottis, every time we swallow, that has to flip up to shield food from going into our lungs. The human swallow is actually, it's an extraordinarily complex mechanism that isn't really even entirely understood. Once you know how complex it is, you wonder how we manage to swallow successfully. But yes, it's a precarious physiology that we all share.
Well, and the list of things that people have swallowed or did swallow and then were taken out by Dr. Jackson include, and there's some pictures in here, for instance, a pair of miniature, I guess it's toy binoculars.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, the toy binoculars. You can imagine how, where a child is concerned, that maybe we forget that we initially get to know the world through our mouths. And so before we have language, we come to know the world through our mouths. We differentiate the world from ourselves, the me, the not me, the object world, the corporeal world, by way of our mouths. And there's something appealing, too, for children about putting something in their mouth as a way of knowing it, sometimes as a way of owning it, sometimes a way of soothing themselves. I mean, what is a pacifier, after
Indeed.
All? And so the binoculars make so much sense to me. There's
there's an X-ray, and you see this tiny little pair of binoculars.
Yes. Well, and you know, when you see the tiny pair of binoculars in the X-ray, then that takes us into the other realms of fascination that the foreign body collection gives rise to. Because, you know, there's something rather uncanny about that. It looks as though in X-ray that the object is so much larger than the body, or you get the sense of interruption. And this is another thing that appeals to me about the collection, the way it gets us to think about and contemplate incongruity, interruption, those things, again, they're part of the imaginative draw of the collection. I don't want to, at the same time, foreground that at the, you know, expense of the real matter of what happens to people when they when they do this. But those things are related. You know, that's what the beauty of the collection.
You do have a picture here in your book, Mary, of a sword swallower.
Yes.
And one has to, I think, make this connection between, I guess, what it takes to swallow a sword and perhaps even what Chevalier Jackson was able to develop.
Yes. Well, a lot of people don't know that sword swallowing and endoscopy, the history of endoscopy, go hand in hand.
And makes sense, right?
Yeah, and that originally the first endoscopists were actually both inspired and instructed by sword swallowers. I've gotten to know a contemporary sword swallower in the course of my work, a man named Dan Meyer, who is the president of International Sword Swallowers Association.
Wow.
And I'm a tremendous admirer of his work. I have a lot of respect for him in this sense. I think that anytime someone rehabituates the body to do something that it seems
doesn't
want to do,
it's going to reject.
Absolutely. There's something worth thinking about there.
Mm-hmm. Many of the stories associated with these foreign objects were accidents, and no surprise, many of them children, because as we were talking about earlier, that's how children understand the world, and we all know about children who put things in their mouth. But you also write about, and this goes back to the 1920s, mm-hmm. that there were some, maybe a group of women, or it was even a bit of a, I'm not going to say fad, but something that women did where they swallowed pieces of hardware.
Yeah, women and men, but it seems like we have more cases perhaps of women. These are cases of multiple foreign body ingestion. And so where on purpose, voluntary, if one person swallowing hundreds of items. This particular woman, whose case I read about in a 1927 issue of Literary Digest, worked at a notions counter in a department store. And I try to understand her case in its cultural context. I think there's nothing that human beings do that isn't in some way suggested to them by their culture and their cultural moment. And it's not always, you know, it's not reducible to an individual psychic disposition or kookiness or craziness or even psychosis, but, or if we say psychosis is culturally informed. And so I understand that act as having something to do with the machine age in which she lived, in which people were being made to think of themselves as machine-like. And so I understand it in that context.
To experience something, I mean, to ingest something is to experience it in its most sort of elemental way.
Absolutely. Right? This isn't the only way of making sense of it. And I think that, quite frankly, in the contemporary moment, voluntary swallowing still confounds psychologists. It's a huge problem. And I think it's because it introduces so many variables. I think that when people do this, they're not necessarily eating. We don't understand that. We don't understand the distinction between putting something in one's mouth in order to fulfill an appetite and treating the stomach as something other than the seat of appetite. The body is being thought of in different ways. And so sometimes it has to do with testing one's capacity. Sometimes it has to do with self-injury. Sometimes it has to do with self-pleasuring, self-harm, as I've already noted, self-injury.
And it's not unusual, or it's not shockingly unusual to mix sort of pain and pleasure.
Absolutely. I find it interesting, too, though, that rarely do we find ourselves asking, well, what was it that motivated doctors to insert non-nutritive items in the way of instruments into the human body? But, you know, we're more likely to think there's something quite odd about a person choosing to swallow something themselves.
It does test the system, does it not?
Yes, it does. And I think it is about testing boundaries. There's a doctor in Rhode Island Hospital named Stephen Moss, a gastroenterologist, who's recently published an article because he has been having to treat weekly cases of voluntary ingestion. And he's confounded by the problem. The psychiatrist at the hospital, he notes that sometimes these people are dealing with anxiety disorders, manic depression, PICO, which is, you know, a DSM-4 category, which frankly I think really...
Like eating dirt and paper.
Yes, which
like
really,
that.
It's so variable that it doesn't really, it describes everything and nothing. And part of his point is that, is also my point, which is that there's so many potential psychological dispositions that might predispose someone to do this that it cannot really be pinned down. We could also think of it as relative to or on a continuum with eating disorders. So
sure.
We could put it in the context of bulimia and anorexia.
Yeah, with it.
But we're back to this idea that the mouth is the seat of so many things in humans, not just appetite, but knowledge and desire and aggression.
And Mary, I have to say, one of the most frightening x-ray in this book is an x-ray of a child. And inside the child are, it looks like, 1, 2, 3 open safety pins. And Chevalier Jackson described this as his most difficult case. But there's this x-ray. There's the little, you know, rib cage of the child. And there are these menacing-looking safety pins. What's the story behind that?
It's horrifying. This was case number 1071. 9-month-old baby found with 4 interlocking safety pins wound together with a piece of wool. What you can't tell, unless doing more careful research, is that, interestingly, the child did not come to the hospital because of this problem. He was being treated for another problem, and they happened to notice in his stools that there were pins in his stools.
Oh, wow.
So then they examined him more carefully and discovered these pins in his throat. Yes, Jackson he extracted the pins in 3 separate attempts. Usually it only took him 1 attempt. And the first attempt lasted 36 minutes, the second 24 minutes,
wow.
The third 19 minutes. This is without anesthesia.
And a child.
Of course, with a child, a baby would be counterindicated anyway, but it's really barely imaginative feat. He had to disentangle the pins without harming the child, you know, using an instrument the size of a drinking straw. And he also had to, in this case, he was forced to place the 2 lowermost pins into the baby's stomach. He usually, of course, preferred not to have to do that. Yeah. And so later they were recovered in the stools. Then he closed and removed the 2 uppermost pins by the more regular oral method through the mouth. The other thing I discovered about this case, and this baby survived, and again, this is what Jackson won't tell us, because Jackson always wants to say, he called safety pins danger pins, and he was on a crusade to suggest that mothers were always to blame because they were careless. But again, what I found about this case is that actually an older sister fed the baby those pins. Children play this way a lot. I just read a blog tale just the other day of a girl telling a story of how she was left in a swing by her mom and her older sister. Each time she would come up in the swing, her older sister had a jar of pennies. She'd feed her a penny. Each time she'd arrive, she'd feed her another penny.
Sounds
like fun.
To me. Indeed.
But yes, the safety pins, these were most usual among the objects, so dangerous, and so often found in infants.
Now, he lived a long life, Chevalier Jackson.
Yes.
Where is he buried?
He is buried in West Laurel Hill Cemetery.
Do you love Chevalier Jackson?
I do. I consider him a dear friend, and I feel very fortunate to have discovered his story. And I feel that it's blessed my own in many ways.
That was my interview with author Mary Capello, conducted in 2011. She joined me to discuss her book Swallow, Farm Bodies, Their Ingestion, Inspiration, and the Curious Doctor Who Extracted Them. You're listening to the Philadelphia Science Festival edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear from neurologist David Eagleman about how we make decisions and the battle between the conscious and unconscious mind. Stay with us. Welcome back to the science-centric edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So much of who we are and what we do is dictated by our unconscious. Every decision we make, from the mundane to the life-changing, is the result of the culmination of all of our lived experiences filtered through our brain's subconscious. We may take credit for the reasoning and higher-level thinking involved, but neurologist David Eagleman argues that it's our unthinking mind that guides us through our everyday lives. He joined me in 2011 to discuss the ongoing battle between the conscious and unconscious mind, which he explored in his book Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Let's take a listen. Did you consciously agree to this interview?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Because your brain is running all sorts of operations under the hood. Your brain is the most complicated thing we've ever found in the universe. It's running just an unbelievably complex number of operations under there. In neuroscience, we're trying to, you know, just scratch the surface of understanding this organ, which essentially is like an alien kind of computational device. It might as well be something that crash-landed here from another planet. it does all sorts of decision making and evaluating of possibilities and simulating possible futures. And then it serves up an idea to us. And we're a funny kind of creature because then we take credit for that idea. We say, hey, I just thought of something. So you may not have
consciously agreed to this interview. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, likely I didn't. I mean, likely everything in my life leading up to this point, plus the genes that I came to the table with and the environment that I interacted with, gave me a particular kind of brain. And yes, it all led up to this moment. So nice to be here.
Well, nice to have you here. You use wonderful language to describe our brain and how it works and how this sort of mix of consciousness and unconsciousness work or don't work together. And in many ways, you describe it like a parliament. And I'm thinking of the British Parliament and the kind of yelling and screaming that seems to go on in their parliament. Is that a helpful way to understand what might be going on in our brain?
Yeah, so I argue for this team of rivals hypothesis, which is that you're not made up of one thing, but instead you're made up of a number of subpopulations in your brain that are all battling it out to control the ship of state. And just like different political parties, the Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians and so on, they all love their country, but they just have different ways of going about it. And that's exactly what happens with these different parts of your brain. This is why people can argue with themselves or cuss at themselves or get mad at themselves or do behaviors that they then look back on and say, gosh, why did I do that? The question is, who's the I? Is there any real meaningful concept of saying there is an I? More likely, the right way to look at it is how Walt Whitman nailed it. And he said, I am large. I contain multitudes.
Well, are we talking about, and I don't want to belabor this too much here, but are we talking about the American Congress where members will say, and, you know, my friend from Texas, the gentleman from Texas, or are we talking more about the British Parliament where they really do yell at each other? You know what I mean?
Well, it depends on the personality of the person. Yeah, some people are more like the Americans, some more like the Brits. Right. Different personality types. I mean, some people are very good at sort of finding ways of negotiating between the parts of their brain. Other people really suffer from it. There are several examples I use in the book about battles between short and long-term decision-making, which is one of the clearest battles to see in all of us. So if I put a bowl of Doritos in front of you, part of your brain really wants to eat those, and part of your brain says, don't eat them. It's a carb fest, and I'm not going to eat them. And so you have this battle, and you go back and forth. I know for myself, I always end up losing that battle. You know, it's a sort of classic example of part of you wanting one thing, part of you wanting to stay fit and healthy, and so you're fighting it out, and the battle tips one way or the other. But some people have battles that are much more insidious than that. For example, people who are, let's say, the CEO of a company and you know, really successful in life in some ways, but they have something like pedophilia that drives them to collect child pornography, something like that, and they know they're not supposed to be doing it, and they can't stop themselves because in this battle of short and long term, the short term keeps winning, and then they end up losing everything. They end up in jail for the next 2 decades. You know, it's these sorts of battles that people really have to worry about, and they're more like the British Parliament in that sense.
But are you saying that when we think kind of long term and perhaps even say, you know, this is the person I'm going to marry or spend the rest of my life with, that's a kind of conscious decision that we make. And then those short term decisions or reactions are based on things that we're not aware of, that's the unconscious mind at work?
Yeah, it can often come down to that. It turns out that even some of the long-term decision-making happens unconsciously. But in general, the way we think about the conscious mind is it's sort of like the long-term vision planner for the company. It's like the CEO of a company that says, okay, look, I don't really understand all the operations going on in this massive company of 60,000 people, but I can sort of set the goal for where this company wants to go over the next 5 years. And when I set that goal, I will assume that all the machinery of the company beneath me will adjust itself to match that goal, even if I don't know what's going on in every cubicle and in the mail rooms and so on. And that's sort of what consciousness is like, the long-term goal setter.
Well, you write about Freud, and frankly, I was thinking about Freud, and of course, this is before MRIs and all that, and he seemed to understand the power of the unconscious, the impulses, the experiences that impact the conscious, and of course, part of analysis is trying to make the unconscious conscious so that people can be responsible for their decisions. Are you playing off of that as well, although bringing it kind of a scientific twist?
Actually, no. Okay, so Freud was the first guy to really nail this idea of the unconscious. It had been sort of bubbling around in the scientific literature for a few hundred years, but really in a small way, and nobody was paying attention to it. And Freud was the guy who opened the box on this. I think where modern neuroscience has departed from Freud is in this idea that we can access the unconscious. At least I can tell you my own view, which is that the unconscious runs on its own programming language that wouldn't even make sense to us. It's not like we can speak to it in English and, you know, understand what it's saying or something. What's happening down there is in the brain, you have hundreds of millions of specialized cells called neurons, the cells of the brain, and they're communicating with each other. Each one of them is popping off signals up to hundreds of times a second, and you've got hundreds of millions of these, and each one of these is connected to each other in such a staggering sort of complexity that it bankrupts the English language. And that's what's actually happening under the hood, and we would have no way to communicate with it in a meaningful way. I think the difference is that we can sort of understand our motivations. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we can, but not always, I think.
Well, and that has nothing to do with toilet training, right?
I mean, the interesting thing about something like toilet training is
right.
One of the main things that the brain is doing is it's constantly reconfiguring its own circuitry. That's what we mean by learning and memory. When you want to do something, let's say you're a toddler and your mother's trying to teach you how to use the toilet, you're automatizing these behaviors. And so most of what the brain does is it automatizes things, which means it burns it down into the circuitry of the brain such that it becomes automatic and unconscious. Maybe a better example is when you're learning how to ride a bicycle, you have to really do a lot of conscious concentration to figure out what you're doing and how to wobble and move your body. But after a while, once it gets burned into the circuitry, you no longer have conscious access. If someone asks you how you ride a bicycle, you can't answer it anymore.
Well, I'm also thinking of that experience of driving a car. You get into your car, you take the route that you've always taken home, you drive into your driveway and you say to yourself, how did I get here? That you have no actually conscious memory of making all the decisions that had to go into getting home in a car.
Well, that's right. That's a good example. And in fact, that's where the brain wants to be, having everything sort of automated. So if the brain is doing its job correctly, it's predicting the future well, it's learning the rules of the world and how to react to them. And in the absolute ideal scenario, it wouldn't have to burn much energy at all. Because remember, we're mobile creatures that run on batteries. We don't get to plug ourselves into a wall. And so the main constraint for the brain is saving energy. And the way it does that is by saying, okay, if I learn all the rules of the world and predict everything correctly, then I've got it. I don't need to pay attention. I don't need to figure out new things. The conscious CEO of the company gets to go to sleep at the desk and the company runs itself just fine. And it's only when things violate our expectations that the conscious mind has to come online and wake up and figure out what the heck to do.
It's often described that these two parts of our brain are, in a sense, or ourselves, I guess, at war with each other. But it sounds from your description that they largely work well together.
Well, it depends. It turns out that the conscious mind is usually best left out of lots of operations that are well automatized in the brain. So if you really start thinking about how you're playing the piano, you're dead. Or if you start thinking too much about how you're writing your signature, you're going to screw it up.
Well, and that, of course, is the free will question. I know you've been asked this a lot, because when you talk about this, you know, the unconscious mind in control of so much what we do, that does raise questions about whether we have free will or whether we know that we have it and whether we use it at all. Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, it turns out that there's no killer experiment in the end that shows us at this point whether we have free will or we don't. A lot of neuroscientists land on the side that we probably don't have free will, because you've got this massive machinery of the brain and every part of the brain is driving other parts of the brain and driven by other parts of the brain. And because it's essentially a vast mechanical network, it's difficult to see where you can slip in the ghost in the machine of free will. And what we know for sure is that you are absolutely dependent on the integrity of this tissue in your skull, because when that changes, you change. If there's a little bit of brain damage, that can change your personality entirely. It can change your ability to see colors or assess risk or simulate futures, things like that. So we know that somehow you are tied to this machinery, and there doesn't seem to be anything else driving this machinery besides itself. And that's why most neuroscientists like to think you don't have free will. I'm not so sure. It may be that our science is just too young for us to understand how that works. But what it has become clear to me, and what I write about in the book, is that if we have free will, it's actually a much smaller player in the game than anyone previously thought. And the reason is your brain comes about as a very complex tangle of genes and environment, and essentially what you come to the table with, and all of your – every one of your experiences combines to build your brain. And what that means is that brains are very different from one another. Brains are more like fingerprints in the sense that they're different in everyone. What that means is that your brain and Jeffrey Dahmer's brain are really, really different. And he can't say, I'm going to use my free will to be just like Marty. And you can't say, I'm going to use my free will to be just like Jeffrey Dahmer. Because your brains have developed on completely different trajectories. It's an interesting thing because when people look at someone else and say, well, I can't believe he did that, the fact is it's sort of impossible to put yourself in somebody else's shoes neurally. Because if you didn't have in utero cocaine poisoning and lead paint on your walls and this whole particular set of childhood experiences that this person had, you're just not like them on the inside. There's as much variation on the inside as there is on the outside with the way people's faces look.
And David, I'm sure you've been asked this before. I know you've been interviewed a lot on this book. And when you talk about free will and people's brains and their various actions, it does raise questions about responsibility, whether we are responsible for our own actions, even if there are things going on that we might not be aware of or be in control of.
It may be that we have some little bit of free will, but it's clear that it's really just a bit player in what's going on. And what I think that means for us is that the whole notion of responsibility is a complicated one. Maybe it's not the right question for us to ask. One of the examples I use in the book is, just as a way of getting into the heart of the problem, is this example of Charles Whitman, who some listeners will remember in 1966 climbed to the top of the tower at University of Texas Austin campus and started shooting people. And he killed dozens of people before he was finally killed. And so what happened is the police force found at his home that he'd also killed his wife and his mother the night before. And he'd left a suicide note saying, something inside me has been changing over the last year. And when this is all over, I want an autopsy to be performed. And so that's exactly what happened. They performed an autopsy and they found that he had a brain tumor that had been growing in his head. And it had impinged on a part of his brain called the amygdala, which is involved in fear and aggression. You know, it's impossible to know whether that was the reason for it, but it certainly seems likely. There was nothing about him that had presaged that kind of behavior otherwise. So when you look at things like that and you think, my gosh, well, what does that mean? Obviously, he didn't choose to have a brain tumor, and anybody else could have the bad luck of having a brain tumor. Well, it turns out we see these kinds of cases all the time. Another example I use in the book is this man who became a pedophile, and his wife had him arrested because he made a move on their prepubescent stepdaughter. And the night before sentencing, he was having these terrible headaches and went for a scan and found out he had a massive frontal tumor. When the tumor was removed, his sexual appetite returned completely to normal. About 6 months later, he became a pedophile again. He started showing signs of pedophilia again. His wife took him back to the hospital. Turns out the surgeons had missed a piece of the tumor and it was regrowing, and they removed it again, and now his sexual appetite returned to normal again. What these examples illustrate is this whole notion of responsibility is quite complicated. I mean, you don't choose to have a tumor, and you are tied irrevocably to this 3 pounds of tissue in your skull.
I know that you probably heard this as well, which is that we only use a certain small portion of our brain. Is that true?
It's actually not true. Sort of the opposite is true, which is that your brain is always screaming along with activity under the hood. In any way that we measure brains, we find that that is just pumping along on all cylinders. And it's only your conscious mind that may or may not have much access to what's going on. I think the reason that myth stuck around for so long about only using a fraction of our brain is because it has this implied hope that you might, you know, do something to get sort of, you know, lots smarter. But the truth is that your brain is always moving. It's just that you may or may not have access to what's going on there.
You write about something called dethronement, and this takes us back to when, I guess it was Galileo, right? It was who famous, my ignorance is on display there, that figured out that the Earth was not the center of the universe, and that was, you know, a great come down for human beings. But it sounds like there's a certain kind of dethronement going on with, from your perspective, from our conscious and our unconscious mind. Yes?
That's right. So Galileo nailed the evidence that the Earth was not at the center, right. And then a lot of dethronements happened. Shortly after that, there was a Scottish farmer who looked at sedimentary layers and figured out that, in fact, you know, the Earth is not 4,000 years old, but more like 4.5 billion years old. Then there was quantum mechanics showing us that reality is too weird for us to understand, and Darwin showing us that we're actually cousins with all the other animals around us. There were a number of scientific dethronements in a row, and what's happening with the brain is this fall from the center of ourselves. We're finding that we're not really the ones driving the boat in our mental lives. But what I argue is that there's really an upside to dethronement. When we thought the Earth was at the center of everything, that was pretty neat. But we now have such a more wondrous and subtle picture of the cosmos around us. There are hundreds of billions of suns just like ours, and any one of them might have planets around it with life forms and extraterrestrial civilizations. And it's opened up something so much grander than we would have ever thought. And that's exactly what's happening in brain science. We're sailing into this inner cosmos and finding all kinds of alien life forms there and realizing that the whole thing is much more wondrous and subtle than we could have ever imagined.
And is that a possibilianism?
That's right. Possibilianism is closely related to that, which is that it's just essentially an appreciation of the vastness of the mystery that we find ourselves surrounded with. So I've sort of accidentally started this new movement called Possibilianism, which merely says, you know, instead of subscribing to any sort of particular dogma, just go out there with an open mind to study the mystery and wonder that surrounds us.
That was my 2011 interview with neurologist David Eagleman, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. You're listening to the science-focused edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from another neurologist about how sound and hearing shape the human experience. Stay with us. This is Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times in Review. Or are you hearing Radio Times in Review? What's the difference between listening and hearing anyway? Is there a difference? Our brain is inundated with sound throughout the day, and we unwittingly navigate between the sounds we ignore and the sounds we pay attention to. I discussed how we experience sound and the effect it has on our brain with neurologist Seth Horowitz when he joined me in 2013. He had recently published his book on the topic called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Let's hear, or let's listen. Would you say that a hearing, sound, listening, that is an unappreciated sense?
Definitely, because one of the ironies of hearing is that we don't pay attention to sound. We use sound to drive our attention to other things so we can look at them. And one of the reasons that this is true is that hearing is much faster than vision. When you think about how most people get around the world, the sighted world, you know, you look at something, you identify it, you read a book, you look around your environment to get information. But vision is quite slow. It operates at a few times per second. So, and there's something good about this. You know, if you had vision that could see something popping up and identify it every 50 one-thousandths of a second, it would be very hard to make a movie because you'd look at a movie and see a bunch of still images just flashing before your eyes. But because it's relatively slow, we see a series of still images presented 10 times a second or faster as a moving image. Sound and the way that we hear is operating anywhere from 20 to 100 times faster than that. So sound is operating in the background. It gets into our brain and it gives us environmental information out of line of sight and in total darkness without worrying too much about the operating speed. We see at about the same rate that we consciously think. you're able to identify sounds and react to them in 50 milliseconds to 100 milliseconds. That's a millisecond is a thousandth of a second. So if you're walking down an alleyway and you're a little bit nervous about it because it's dark, you can't see, and suddenly you hear a sound, a loud sound somewhere around you, you will jump, you'll startle. You'll suddenly hunch up your shoulders, and you'll start turning your head to look for the source of the sound. This is something that occurs in less than a tenth of a second, and it's because of a direct connection from your ears to your spinal cord and your motors to get you to react much faster than you ever could visually.
In fact, you write, and I found this very helpful, that we should think of our hearing as an alarm system.
Exactly. It was, you know, very important, especially, you know, way back when, before we had houses and security systems and webcams. It was very useful to hear something sneaking up on you in the dark, especially if you couldn't hear it. And one of the things that most people don't realize is that your ability to localize where a sound is coming from, if you're paying attention to it, is almost the same resolution as it is visually. It's a couple of degrees. And people who have lost sight, they say that they can resolve where a sound is coming from just as well as I could. But it's something that you have to pay attention to, and most of us don't, because attention requires additional brain processing, additional energy expenditure, and it's hard to get people to actually listen to a sound when we've basically evolved to have it run in the background to alert us of problems.
As you said, we live in a world awash with sounds. It's interesting how when we don't pay attention, we don't hear.
Right. One of the things is that hearing is something that every living thing with a backbone does. And as I said, it's our alarm system. But listening requires the addition of attention. It's separate pathways in the brain. So that if you actually listen to music or listen to someone's speech very carefully, you're getting a very different kind of cognitive response to it. It's the difference between just putting on your headphones and going for a run and listening to whatever playlist you've come up with versus going to a live concert and attending to the music and letting it physically wash over you. It's a different way to use your brain, and it's something that we seem to do less and less as we're getting overwhelmed, especially with auditory information in our environment.
And you think we are getting overwhelmed?
I think so. I mean, a lot of people claim, oh, I'd like to find some place which is silent and sort of quiet. It's harder and harder to find that. And neurons and parts of your brain actually respond to silence. And they don't necessarily respond in a good way. Neurons will suddenly start synchronizing. And neurons are the individual nerve cells, and there's 100 billion of them in your brain. If there's suddenly a loss of signal, if you're suddenly not hearing something, a lot of them start synchronizing, waiting for the next signal. And sometimes this signal feeds into parts of your brain that are responsible for arousal and emotion, so that you're really getting nervous in sudden silence or unexpected silence just because there's supposed to be something happening.
You describe a percussionist, a woman named Evelyn Glennie, who I've actually interviewed, and she is a mostly, largely deaf percussionist, a world-class musician. How is she able to do what she's able to do? And it's really quite extraordinary.
It is amazing. I was really honored to be able to work with her. I'm working with a group called the Just Listen Project. It was wonderful that I was able to actually go and hear her. She was playing a concert marimba, which is basically a car-sized instrument. What she would do, she came out barefoot. So she's picking up vibrations of this through the floor. She also was arranging the resonators, which are these tubes that sit underneath the strike plates of the marimba, so that the vibrations from that would come out and strike her shin. I also watched that when she was playing the marimba, she had her neck back, and she's picking up vibrations along the neck and the upper part of the chest, which is a very, very sensitive area. Also, when she was playing the snare drum, she was curled over the instrument. So she's using her entire body to pick up the vibrations that, for the most part, she couldn't hear. So she really helped redefine music for me in that it's not just something that comes in through your ears, but it's something that drives your perception throughout your whole body. And one of the fun things about it was that I was allowed to do some recording, so I was able to set up my own little microphones, but I also used some specialized equipment called geophones. These are low-frequency microphones that are used to record earthquakes. So they only pick up very, very low frequencies. What I was able to pick up was the difference between what we were hearing, listening to the sound in the room, versus the vibrations, which is what she was picking up, not through her ears, but through her body and through her skin.
Well, speaking of music and musicians, I do want to play a Mozart sonata for two pianos in D major. And there was a fair amount of interest in some science, the idea that there was this Mozart effect and it would help you have smarter children. And it didn't necessarily turn out to be true. But let's listen to this piece of music. And then I'd love to have you, Seth, describe what it is that we're hearing and why it might be helpful, but maybe not in ways that were touted early on. Let's listen. That's just a little excerpt from Mozart's A Sonata for Two Pianos in D major. So from, a scientific point of view, what are we hearing?
Well, what you're hearing is extremely harmonic sounds played at what would be considered a human scale. It's played on acoustic instruments so that nothing has been particularly distorted. Nothing is played beyond the range of normal human processing. Mozart's music was very, very temporally regulated, with long-term repetitions and short-term changes that are very much in the range of a normal auditory neural processing. So it's something that can help the brain pick up on harmonic structure, pick up on specific patterns. And the brain loves patterns. Your brain is basically a wet, squishy, pattern-seeking machine. And classical music, such as this Mozart piece, is very good at combining harmonics, which is a regular pattern of acoustic energy, along with regular tempos. Both of these are very good for helping the brain set up specific pathways. Every time you hear something or every time you think, your brain is changing, not just changing what chemicals it's putting out, but will rewire itself. If you hear something that's very familiar, like your name, the first time you hear your name when you were a little kid, it's just sort of like they said blah, blah, blah. But over time, you hear your name a lot, or you'll hear a C major chord a lot because you're being played kids' songs. What this does is your brain actually rewires itself so it becomes easier and easier to pick up these sounds with normal harmonic relationships. So listening to music can have a positive effect on your brain.
Right.
The problem emerged in 1993 when Rauscher, Shaw, and Kai published a neat little study in Nature, which said that if you listen to about 10 minutes of this particular Mozart piece, you saw an increase in a specific part, the Stanford-Binet intelligence test, specifically one having to do with spatial reasoning. Now, that's a lot of words to describe the result, and it was a statistically significant finding. So what happened was it got picked up because it was in Nature, a very well-known journal. And suddenly, the findings started getting shortened. The shortening turned into listening to Mozart makes you smarter. And it just kept snowballing. And to the point that the governor of Georgia decided that he was going to put a line item in the budget so that every new mother got a cassette tape of classical music. And for some reason, someone in Texas decided they were only going to play Mozart in prison. But I didn't hear about an increase in escape, so I guess it didn't help their spatial reasoning too much. But it finally came to the point that the authors had to write a little letter saying, you'd be better off spending the money on musical education than you would than giving all these mothers a classical tape.
As I was reading your book, I don't know why, I kept hearing the sounds of casinos. Obviously, a completely fabricated soundscape. And of course, at a casino, there's no sense of time. You don't know whether it's day or night. And then casinos have created this kind of ambient sound. Let's listen to this. Seth Horowitz, as someone that has looked at some of the psychological uses of sound, what are casino owners doing to their patrons?
They're following a very basic psychophysical rule, which is that loud sounds are basically bad. It increases your arousal. It gets you revved up. And in natural world, if you're just sitting outside and you hear something loud, what you want to do is move away from it. It could be an earthquake. It could be something coming to eat you. So at a basic level, we respond to loud as being something big and probably dangerous. But if you go into a place voluntarily that's loud, what you're doing is you're seeking the arousal. At least around here, if you go into the casinos, it's very quiet when you walk in at first. But as soon as you walk into the gaming room, there's this enormous wall of sound. And it's bells and human voices and announcements. And it's very loud, and it gets your blood pumping and gets your heart racing and your blood pressure goes up. It gives you all the symptoms of a fight-or-flight syndrome, but you've elected to be there. What the loudness does is it increases any behavior you can do to get control over your environment, because the loud sound seems to be out of your control. And in a loud restaurant, it'll make you drink faster. A loud gym, the theory is that it'll make you run faster or work out faster. In a casino, it'll make you gamble faster. But it's not that simple. The context will make a big difference. There was one study which looked at gambling and loud noises, and it found that people who have self-admitted gambling problems found the loud noises aversive because they had associated with losing in the past, whereas people who just didn't have a gambling problem would go in and gamble more because they would associate it with the occasional win. It's related to why me with my 50-year-old ears, I'm not going to go anywhere near an Abercrombie and Fitch store because there's a corporate mandated loudness level between 80 and 90 decibels. But kids who enjoy the arousal and have younger ears than me will go in there and probably spend more money.
You have a chapter in your book about movies and music. I love movies, and I'm also much more educated today about the use of sound in movies to enhance the story, to help us understand character. And I do want to play the main title theme of John Williams' legendary score for the original blockbuster Jaws. And it's going to start quietly, but I think you know it's where it's going to go. Let's listen to this, and then, Seth, we can talk afterwards. There it is, the main title to Jaws, of course, the John Williams legendary score, and it's so effective. How come?
It's an amazing, iconic piece.
It is.
What was it doing? It was about building tension, and as I said before, loud often signals danger, but so does low pitch. Mm-hmm. What most people don't know about is the fact that there's a really tight relationship in your brain between the pitch of something, the frequency it puts out, and its size. If a mouse comes up to you and squeaks, it's not too menacing. It's a very high-pitched sound. But if you hear that kind of low-pitched wham, wham that the tuba was doing, it gets right down into your brainstem and says, large, dangerous animal. And if you go into a good theater with a good sound system, you're not just getting low-frequency, normal-hearing sound. You're also getting those infrasonic vibrations. A tuba can really just make you feel it right in your chest. And those kind of sounds, you don't even have to process it very much. It goes to very baseline levels area of your brain and said, there's something scary coming. And the fact that it's going slowly and occasionally at the beginning and then speeding up and getting louder means whatever this is, it's getting closer. And that was the whole point. And that's why it was just brilliant emotional composition.
And that was my 2013 interview with neurologist Seth Horowitz, author of the book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And that wraps up the Philadelphia Science Festival edition of Radio Times in Review. If you want more information about the festival, including a calendar of events, visit philasciencefestival.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for listening.